It's time for Bigler's World. And I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour. What do I got here? I got a little Dogo news is what I'm going to start with. But I got some National Geographic Kids magazine, maybe a little Ranger Rick over here someplace. How about some science news? Let's do this article from Dogo. It's news. It's for kids. Caitlin Clark's incredible scoring record shines light on women's basketball, says Jono Sisson, who wrote this article. Interest in women's college basketball has been raising steadily in the past few years. A large part of the sport's increasing popularity is attributed to Caitlin Clark. The 22-year-old point guard for the Iowa Hawkeyes is credited with bringing mainstream attention to a sport historically overshadowed by its men's counterpart. According to the NCAA, the Caitlin Clark effect, that's in quotes, helped set a new total attendance record of 8,784,401 for Division I women's basketball during the 2022-23 season. This number surpassed the previous record by over 150,000, the 2023 NCAA championship game between Louisiana State, LSU, and Iowa State attracted 10 million viewers, or about twice the number of people who watched the 2022 championships. The 2023-24 season has been particularly thrilling for Clark's fans. On February 15th of 2024, the University of Iowa senior scored the 3,528th point. I messed that up somehow. Of her career, I'll say 3,528 in a game against Michigan, setting a new record for the most points in women's NCAA history. Kelsey Plum, who played for the University of Washington from 2013 to 2017, previously held the record with 3,529 points. Almost 2 weeks later, on February 28th, 2024, Clark shattered the all-time women's record of 3,649 points. It was set by Lynette Woodard, there it is, back in 1981, just before the NCAA era. On March 3rd of 2024, Clark made further history by surpassing Pete Maravich's record of 3,667 points for the most career points in Division I history for men and women. Maravich had held the title since 1970. The NCAA Women's Tournament, which began on March 20th, 2024, have helped extend Clark's lead even further. On March 23rd, the basketball phenom added 27 more points to her record in a resounding 91-65 win against Holy Cross. Clark currently boasts 3,798 points and a 28.3 scoring average across her four-year collegiate basketball career. Let's see, who is this? Clark said this, "Just to be in the same realm of all these players who have been so successful, whether it's Pete, Kelsey Plum, or Lynette Woodard, all these people have just given so much to the game," Clark said. "Hopefully somebody comes after me and breaks my records, and I can be there supporting them." And if that's not impressive enough, on March 8th, 2024, Clark broke the NCAA Division I record for three-pointers, 163 in a season, by a man or woman. The title was previously held by Golden State Warriors point guard Stephen Murray. He set it during a 2007-08 season while playing for the Davidson College Wildcats. Clark is also the first Division I player to top 1,000 assists and 800 rebounds. She has 59 career games with at least 25 points, 5 assists, and 5 rebounds, another NCAA record. This year will be the 22-year-old's final season of college basketball. She has decided to join the WNBA and is expected to be the top pick at the April 15th, 2024 draft. But before that, Clark has one final goal to wrap up her exceptional collegiate basketball career. She wants to help the Iowa Hawkeyes women team win their first ever NCAA championship. Next article here on Bigler's World. Sticking with Dogo News for kids. India, the world's largest democracy, prepares for elections. Daksha Morjaria wrote this particular article. It's a little like this here. In most democratic countries, voters go to the polls on a single predetermined day. However, that is not true in India, the world's largest democracy, with about 970 million registered voters, conducts its elections in seven stages over 6 weeks. Held every 5 years, the election will occur from April 9th of 2024 to June 1st. The results will be announced on June 4th of 2024. What is at stake? Well, the general elections allow residents to select their representatives for the lower house of parliament, known as the Lok Sabha or House of People. It comprises 545 members. The leader of the party that wins the most votes is named the country's prime minister for the next 5 years. Political parties can form a joint government if there is no clear winner. Similar rules apply to other democratic countries. However, India's election process is more complex due to the large number of people standing for election. In 2019, there were over 8,000 candidates representing 2,660 political parties. The two largest parties are the, so you can pronounce this, Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP, led by current Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is seeking his third term, and the Indian National Congress, led by Mappani Karj. In most elections, neither party wins the 272 seats needed to form a single-party government. However, the BJP is expected to win by a landslide this year. A six-week-long election may sound long, but it's the only way poll workers can get to all the eligible voters. The exercise is even more complicated because the electoral rules stipulate that polling booths must be within 1.2 miles of every voter. This year, organizers have set up over 1 million polling stations and hired 15 million people to help with the elections. Why do the ballots have symbols? India's voting ballots feature emoji-like symbols alongside each candidate's name. The drawings include everyday objects like a broom, bell, or flashlight. The icons were introduced at India's first election in 1951 to help the country's population, which was about 80% illiterate, recognize which candidate they were selecting. Let's see, who is this? Kavita Karan, a professor at Southern Illinois University, says, "Symbols made it easier for people to associate themselves with political parties. They are like the logos of companies." The country's literacy rate has risen sharply since, but the drawings remain an essential part of the election process. They appear prominently in the political party's publicity materials. Political parties, however, do not get to design their own symbols. Instead, they pick three symbols in order of choice from a general pool of images maintained by the Election Commission of India, or the ECI. Once the logo has been assigned, it cannot be given to anyone else. This is true even if the political party it represents no longer exists. How much do the elections cost? Elections in the world's largest democracy are expensive affairs. This year's polling exercise is expected to cost a record $14.4 billion, about twice the estimated $7.2 billion spent in 2019. Large part of the funds will be spent on travel and advertisements. However, candidates will also try to lure voters, especially in rural areas, with delicious food, fireworks shows, and dance performances. Rural voters are often bribed with cash, household items like refrigerators, and even livestock like goats. India's secret ballot system makes it hard to gauge the effectiveness of illegal gifts. However, over 90% of the candidates have confessed to using them to stand out in a crowded field. Okay, let us move away from Dogo News and do a little Ranger Rick magazine here. Let's see. Welcome, Matt, for Martians. Or Martins, I'm sorry. it's a bird. Ellen Lambeth wrote this. These birds need a friendly helping hand, and that's exactly what they are getting. The birds in this story are purple martins. the largest species in a family of birds called swallows. Swallows have awesome flying skills. They swoop and swirl toward winged insects. They nab them right out of the air. As you can see in this picture here, a male martin on the right is darker and glossier than his female mate perched next to him. And at left is proof that purple martins, let's see where am I in this article, they like to nest in colonies or groups. That high-rise building for birds is called a gourd rack. Each gourd can hold a single nest built by a mated pair of martins. People who provide such group birdhouses are called purple martin landlords. Some landlords monitor or keep track of the birds in their colonies throughout the breeding season. William Ebel, he's part of a monitoring team in Texas. Here he just lifted an adult male martin from one of the gourds for inspection. The bird is still holding a katydid he caught. See, it commands me to turn the page. See these bird-friendly care, what they're up to here. I will. I'll turn the pages right here. Welcoming the martins. William lives on a ranch with his own martin housing, but in this story, he's helping to monitor a colony on a nearby ranch. This one belongs to the landlord, Julie Maddox. Julie's ranch has several gourd racks. Altogether, they add up to 92 nesting gourds, and each gourd is checked every 4 days during the breeding season. Good thing purple martins are cool with all the nosy humans hanging around. Let's see, Julie really appreciates the help from William and other kids in the area, and the kids are proud to play an important role in this huge community science project. For the birds. You may be wondering, what's the big deal with these birds? And with so many wildlife species, there are way fewer purple martins now than before. That's especially true for martins in the western part of the country. The number of eastern martins has been going down fast, too. They need help. And they're getting it, thanks to people like Joe Seergrist. Joe was a ranger Rick Reeder as a kid, which made him want to grow up to help wildlife. And now that's exactly what he does at the Purple Martin Conservation Association. Joe's work allows him to share his love of martins with others. He teaches people how they, too, can help. He collects the information that Julie and other birds, or purple martin landlords, send to him. That helps him keep track of how the birds do during their breeding season. As you can see in this picture above, he sometimes visits successful colonies like Julie's. New discoveries. Biologist Anna Forsman teamed up with Joe on his visit to Julie's colony. She collects health information from the birds. This may help the team discover things that might harm or help the purple martin population. And also bands the birds. It's like putting an ID bracelet on their legs. When banded martins show up at other times or in other places, those bracelets give Anna, Joe, and other scientists even more information. What the eastern martins really need is more housing. That's because they, and now for some reason, nest only in human-made structures. The racks in this story even come with built-in protections against predators, such as snakes, hawks, or raccoons. More kids getting involved will make a big difference, too. Joe hopes that someday every elementary school in this region will have its own purple martin colony. So what are you waiting for? Ask your teacher to visit purplemartin.org. And click on the Education tab. If your school is in the right zone, offer to help host a new colony there. The Martins and Joe will thank you. What does this say here? Is this an addition to this article? From here to there, the breeding season is just a small part of a purple martin's year. After that, each bird joins others in huge flocks, like the one in this background photo. They are preparing for the long migration back to their winter homes in South America. Little was known about their lives there until now, that is. Clarissa Oliveira. They got a picture of her standing there. She's studying to be a bird biologist in Brazil. She's posing with a purple martin that was caught and inspected and now is ready for release. Both Joe and Anna have visited here to work with Clarissa and other Brazilian scientists. As the two teams share their information with each other, just don't forget what everyone in this story, from kid to property owner to scientist, is working so hard to accomplish. Save our purple martins. Okay, let's do one more article here. From Ranger Rick on Bigler's World. This article is entitled, Recycle This, Not That. Hannah Shart wrote this article. Almost everyone thinks recycling is a good idea, but most people who recycle don't actually do a great job of it. So what's the problem? Well, for one thing, recycling can be confusing. What stuff is really recyclable and what should just go into the trash? The answer? It's complicated. Different cities and countries have different rules about what's recyclable. Always check with your local public works department or private recycling company. Many things are nearly always recyclable, but others, things should never go into that blue bin. It commands me to look at each common throwaway below item and decide where you think it should go, the recycling or trash, and then check your answers. I'm not going to do that right now. I'm just going to read the article. Be a better recycler. No matter where you live, there are things you can do to give your recyclables a better chance of making it through the process. Paper should be clean and dry. Used is okay, but not greasy, shredded, or wet. Food containers should be emptied and rinsed out. Don't crush your cans. A flattened soda can may be mistakenly sorted as paper or cardboard. Put the lid on your soup or tuna can inside the can, then put it in the recycling. A metal lid on its own is too small and sharp to be safely recycled. Milk cartons and other cartons are recyclable in many places, but not all. And let's see, it says scan this code. They give you a code here you can scan to find out. Not sure whether something can be recycled? Look it up. Most communities publish guides that list items that are accepted in local recycling. Sending non-recyclables to a recycling center can cause problems. Trash talk. On average, each person in the United States throws away 5 pounds of trash every day. It's the numbers game. Plastic containers marked with a 1 or 2 are usually recyclable, and those marked with a 5 sometimes are, but most other kinds of plastic aren't recyclable. The small stuff. Nothing smaller than a credit card should ever go into a recycling bin. Small items can get stuck in the machinery. Okay, let's go to Sports Illustrated Kids magazine. This article entitled, Uh-Oh, It's Juju. We called it, it starts out here, former sports kid of the year, Juju Watkins, is revitalizing USC. Cheryl Miller did something last summer she's never done before. She bought USC women's basketball season tickets. Miller is the best player in the history of the program, if not the history of the game. She led the Trojans to glory, 2 NCAA titles in the 1980s, and served as head coach in the 90s. Yet she couldn't remember when she'd last caught a USC game before this season. After all, the Trojans had gone more than 15 years without an NCAA tournament win. But that reality began to shift over the last few years when former Cal head coach Lindsey Gottlieb was hired by USC to lead the program in 2021. She extended an open invitation to former players, welcoming them back to the campus. As soon as the season drew near, however, she realized that she wanted more. Miller was going to come back to Trojan games, she decided, not just occasionally, but as often as possible, as close as she could get. For the first time in her life, Miller bought USC tickets, and she prepared to bear witness. She needed to be in front and center for this. Cheryl Miller wanted to watch Juju Watkins. The 6'2" freshman guard had been the top recruit in the country, boasting a rare combination of skill, size, and speed. She could have played at any school in the country, but the Los Angeles native decided she wanted to restore a program in her hometown. Watkins grew up near the USC campus in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles. She learned to play hoops at a park there that was named for her great-grandfather. A civil rights activist, Ted Watkins, founded the Watts Labor Community Action Committee, which aims to ease poverty and improve quality of life in the neighborhood. He spent decades working to provide affordable housing, jobs, and health care in the area, where those were often scarce. Ted died before Juju was born, but his legacy has always felt very near to her. In 2020, when a 15-year-old Watkins was named SI Kids Sport Kid of the Year, she chose the park as the location for the photo shoot. Ted Watkins' motto was, "Don't move, improve." That principle resonated with his great-granddaughter. It was much bigger than basketball, but it framed her college choice in a way that felt right to her. She says this, "If I stayed at home, I'd have the chance to build something bigger that meant more than if I went anywhere else." Don't move, improve. Watkins took those words to heart and chose USC. She began delivering on the hype immediately. She scored 32 points in her college debut, a statement win over number 7 Ohio State. This kind of performance from her soon felt routine. USC's record for 30-point games in a freshman season had been 3. Watkins passed that 30-point games in November. In February, she did something no USC women's player, not even Miller, had when she passed the 50-point mark, dropping 51 on the road and a win over number 4, Stanford. At one point in the third quarter, she was outscoring the Cardinal 40-39. Watkins has done, in a few months, something no one else had been able to do in her lifetime. She'd return USC's women basketball to national relevance. Her teammates call it the Juju Effect. Sold-out gyms, autograph seekers, an entirely different environment from a year ago. Home attendance has tripled year over year. Celebrities show up at games. Throngs of picture-takers surround the team bus. "And who is this?" says Gottlieb. "That's the kind of stuff I saw when I was in the NBA. Gottlieb was an assistant for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Miller was taking it all from her courtside seats. Taking it in, there it is. Beyond her historic playing career, she coached in both college and the WNBA, in addition to spending years as the broadcast analyst. What comparison does she have for a freshman this dominant, a two-way player so early in her career? There's one other person who really stands out," Miller says, finally, "and that would be me." Next article here, we'll read one more from Sports Illustrated Kids. "Happy Trails" was the name of this article. "The gridiron world said goodbye to 3 iconic coaches over the offseason. But for how long? Football coaches tend to have a hard time letting go. Think about it. They work countless hours a day breaking down film, looking for ways to upgrade their roster, and managing players. Then, when the day is over, they often sleep in the office couch so they can get right back at it bright and early the next morning. A lot of men who have tried to walk away have had a hard time staying away. Consider Paul Brown. For 17 seasons, he was the coach of the Cleveland Browns, and yes, they're named after him. He won 4 championships in the old All-American Football Conference and 3 in the NFL. He was fired in 1963 and inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1967. Not only was his legacy cemented, but he was still on the Browns' payroll, so he was cashing a paycheck for hanging out and playing golf. Then in 1968, at age 60, he came back to become the coach of the expansion Cincinnati Bengals. Why? I was eating my heart out, he said at the time. Football had been my life. I had a strong desire to become alive again. He's not only great to make the return. Joe Gibbs, who won 3 Super Bowls in Washington, returned to the team in 2004, which was 11 years after he retired. Dick Vermeil came out of retirement after a 15-year hiatus in 1997 and ultimately led the Rams to a Super Bowl victory. And the list goes on. So forgive us if we expect to see more of the 3 legendary coaches who left the sidelines following the 2023 season. Nick Saban retired from Alabama, Bill Belichick parted ways with the New England Patriots, and Pete Carroll was bumped to the front office by the Seattle Seahawks. So what do their futures hold? Saban, 72, would be a natural as a television commentator. There it is. Belichick, 71, who was rumored to be in the running for the Atlanta Falcons job, seems the most likely to make a quick return. We can't imagine him just hanging out on the bench without drawing up plays in the sand. The energetic 72-year-old Carroll, who was known for playing pranks on his players and engaging them in snowball fights, seems the most likely to have some fun now that he's not coaching, at least for now. Okay, switching gears, let's do a little science news explores. They got an article here. Rampaging vines are slowly strangling tropical forests. As these lianas overtake trees, the forests will inhale less CO2, worsening climate change, says Douglas Fox, who wrote this article. Ivan Gora still remembers the first time he climbed a tree that had been struck by lightning. The trunk of this strangler fig was as wide as a car. Its leaves were waxy and boat-shaped. At first, the tree didn't look like it had been toasted by 300 million volts of electricity. But as Gora hefted his way up, he saw faint signs that it had been zapped 10 days before. Leaves at the tips of some branches were scorched and dead. Lightning had jumped from these branches to neighboring trees, Gora realized. He also saw that the lightning had traveled from tree to tree across ropey growths known as lianas. They are thick, woody vines. A single liana often extends across multiple trees, wiring them together, and if lightning strikes one, it can now be bad news for the others. Let's see, who is this? Gora says this. What is he? He's a forest ecologist at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York. He says this, lianas are carrying electrical current like jumper cables across the canopy. See, by connecting the trees, the vines might amplify the effects of lightning. Gora encountered these zapped trees on Barra, Colorado Island in Panama, a country in Central America. The trees grow on a densely forested hill in a lake. Here, the whoops of howler monkeys often ring through the air. Liana's ability to spread lightning between trees is just one way they're changing the tropics. For 40 years, liana's numbers have been rising in tropical forests across South and Central America. Their spread may be related to several dry seasons caused by climate change, but one thing is clear, these woody serpents are ripping forests apart. Lianas smother trees in shade, stealing sunlight that could have fueled forest growth. They also topple trees, and as Gora has now found out, they may cause more trees to die when lightning strikes. All this could have dire consequences for the future of Earth's climate. Carbon dioxide, or CO2, levels in the atmosphere are rising faster than ever. People have been counting on tropical forests to absorb some of that extra CO2, but by killing trees and slowing their growths, lianas could now slow down CO2 uptake, boosting global warming. Slow battles. Walk through a tropical forest and you will quickly spot lianas. Their woody stems often spiral up tree trunks. Once they reach the top, they spread their leaves over the canopy. Scientists call lianas and many vine species structural parasites. Sturdy trunks and branches of trees support their weight. That means lianas don't need to spend energy building strong stems. Instead, they can pack those stems full of tubes that quickly pump up water from the roots. And because liana stems are so skinny, they can lengthen more quickly than tree trunks or branches. This allows them to spread rapidly through forests. Let's see, who is this? Jack Putz is a liana botanist at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He says, they are contagious. He once found a single vine that had spread across 49 trees. In the late 1970s, Putz climbed and explored the canopy on Barro, Colorado Island. He was studying the brutal slow-motion battles between lianas and trees. Some trees, he found, try to defend themselves with flimsy branches. These break off easily, sending lianas crashing down. Palm trees, meanwhile, have sawtooth leaves that slice through liana stems. Other trees protect themselves with flexible trunks and branches that thrash wildly during windstorms. This breaks lianas that have spread onto them. But when a liana manages to spread from tree to tree, the consequences can turn very serious. A falling tree can pull down several of its linked neighbors. This creates a sunny gap in the forest. Light-loving lianas then explode into these gaps. Lianas, said Stefan Snitzer, who is a forest ecologist at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Lianas, they can capture a site and hold it open. Snitzer also works for the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama, where he studies liana on Barro, Colorado Island. Grow fast, die young. Lianas are a natural part of tropical ecosystems. The gaps they create in forests can help sun-loving trees take root. Their woody bridges from one treetop to another allow ants and other insects to get around. In fact, these vines boost the diversity of ant species in a forest, along with the birds that eat them. For these reasons, people had assumed lianas and trees had struck a natural balance, that tropical forests were unchanging. But in 1994, Oliver Phillips, he showed this wasn't true. Phillips is currently an ecologist at the University of Leeds in England. Back then, he was analyzing records of tree growth and death in 40 carefully studied tropical forests plots around the world. From 1934 to 1960, he found about one in every 100 trees each year died and was replaced by saplings. By the 1980s, that rate had nearly doubled. Phillips recalls, "This was a great surprise." He wondered if higher CO2 levels were causing trees to grow more quickly and die younger. Plants use CO2 to make sugars they use to grow, but if a tree gets tall quickly, it's entering this zone of increased risk at a younger age, says Phillips. Faster-growing trees often have weaker, spongier wood, so they are more prone to falling in windstorms. Tall trees are also struck more often by lightning, and they have a harder time pulling water from the ground up to their leaves, so they tend to suffer more during droughts. After publishing his findings in the journal Science, Phillips continued monitoring forest plots. In 2002, he published another bombshell, now in the journal Nature. Lianas in tropical forests across Central and South America were increasing by 1.7 to 4.6% each year. So between 1981 and 2001, lianas had almost doubled. Who is the snitzer at Marquette? People were healthfully skeptical. They found them hard to believe. But since then, Snitzer and others have also found lianas increasing in tropical forests around Central and South America. Now, they're trying to understand why. Survival strategies. Snitzer and Gertje van der Heijden have uncovered one important clue. Van der Heijden is a forest ecologist at the University of Nottingham in England. From 2011 to 2016, he and Snitzer monitored the growth of 1,117 trees and 648 lianas in the forest, a short distance south of Barrow, Colorado Island. Trees and lianas grew at the same rate during the wet season, but during the four-month dry season, they found the lianas grew 3 to 4 times more quickly. And during a severe drought in 2015 and 16, trees stopped growing entirely. Meanwhile, lianas continued to grow at their normal rate. This difference could give lianas a huge advantage as the world warms. The dry season in southern Amazon, for instance, has lengthened by about 20 days since 1980. In fact, hot droughts struck the Amazon in 2005, 10, 15, and 16, and yet again in 2023. Billions of trees died. But for several reasons, lianas do well in dry conditions. First, the wilder tubes in their stems help them pull water up to their leaves better than trees do. Lianas also grow their roots more efficiently than trees do. Who is this? Gu works at the Northern Forestry University in Harbin, China. He compared the roots of 69 liana species to those of 127 tree species. Liana roots are less dense, he found. It makes them less expensive to grow than tree roots. That is, the plant needs less fuel to make them. Each gram of root a liana grows adds more than twice as much root length as in a tree. That allows lianas to gulp up more water. Lianas also store more food to help them get through the dry season. Carolyn Signore Mueller, she discovered this while earning her PhD at the University of Campinas in Brazil. She compared sugar and starch levels in lianas and trees. Liana stems contain more of these carbohydrates than trees, she found. This is important because plants can't do photosynthesis as well when water is scarce. They can't convert CO2 into sugars and starches nearly as quickly. Stored carbohydrates provide raw materials for building leaves and stems. The new findings suggest that lianas have food to survive for more time concludes Signor Mueller. She's now an ecophysiologist at the University of Leeds. She shared her findings last August in Tree Physiology. Those findings help explain why lianas grow more quickly than trees during dry times. It could also explain a discovery by one of Schnitzer's former members, Jose Medina Vega. Fast and furious. From late 2015 to early 2017, Medina Vega made frequent visits to the Parque Natural Metropolitano. This protected patch of tropical forest sits on the edge of Panama City. There he stepped into a grated metal basket, and a crane would hoist him some 100 feet in the air. High in the treetops, he heard the squawks of toucans and cries of monkeys interspersed with car horns and traffic. Medina Vega selected branches from dozens of trees and lianas. With a black permanent marker, he labeled every leaf on those branches. 6,861 leaves in all. He then returned every month to check each leaf and look for new ones. This area of Panama has intense dry seasons. Trees and lianas lose their leaves during these times, just as many trees in North America lose their leaves in winter. When the dry season ends, these vines grow new leaves about a month earlier than the trees do. That's probably because they have more food stored up. Sprouting leaves earlier also allows them to replenish food supplies sooner. Compared to trees, lianas' growth is fast and furious, observes Medina Vega. Their skinny stems lengthen 10 to 15 times more quickly than tree branches. Their leaves are also thinner than tree leaves, so lianas can grow more and more quickly using less energy. Their roots also share many of these cheap traits, so lianas can more ruthlessly seek out sunlight in the sky and water in the ground. Medina Vega concludes, "When the opportunity is there, they dominate. They occupy that place." He is now at the Smithsonian Global Earth Observatory Network in Washington, D.C. How vines multiply tree deaths. Gora's lightning study shows that the liana dominance can trigger even bigger changes over time. When he found his first lightning strike in 2015, the trees were still alive. They'd been struck less than 2 weeks earlier. But over the next few months, several trees slowly died. The scent of wounded trees attracted thousands of beetles. They chewed into them, shredding piles of sawdust onto the ground. In time, those piles would grow thigh high. Between 2014 and 2019, Gora studied the effects of 78 lightning strikes on Barra, Colorado Island. On average, each one damaged some 25 trees, killing five or six. But in one patch of the forest quickly connected by lianas, a single strike damaged 113 trees. More than 50 of these died, says Gora. Some of the most damaged sites appear to be places where there's lots of lianas. Let's see, he, Schnitzer, and Stephen Janovec reported their findings in March 23rd. Phytologist? Yankovic is Gora's former PhD advisor at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Let's see, says Schnitzer, clearly lianas are increasing mortality rates, then they take advantage of that. And this vicious cycle could have major consequences for us all. Carbon problems. The world's tropical forests currently inhale some 10 billion tons of CO2 each year. They turn it into leaves and wood. In doing so, they absorb almost one-third of the CO2 that people emit each year. This keeps global CO2 levels and temps from rising even more quickly than they have so far. The spread of lianas may soon throw off that balance. From 2012 to 2015, Schnitzer and van der Heijden oversaw an experiment just south of Barro, Colorado Island, that showed this. Using machetes, workers cut down all lianas in several plots of the forest. 3 years later, they returned to measure tree growth there. They also estimated how much CO2 had been absorbed. Then they compared these plots to the one where lianas hadn't been removed. Lianas had reduced forest CO2 absorption by a whopping 76%. That's about 9.8 U.S. tons per hectare per year. A hectare is about 1.4 soccer fields, by the way, says Schnitzer. Even small impacts on these forests can influence the global carbon cycle. The boom in lianas over the past 40 years may already be preventing forests from absorbing millions of tons of CO2 each year. Between 1990 and 2015, the amount of CO2 absorbed each year by the Amazon fell by 60%, one large study showed. This was mainly due to higher rates of tree death. Trees that grow faster are dying younger. Lianas, droughts, and heat waves are all taking a toll. And people continue to build roads and cut large swaths of forest. Whether trees fall on their own or are cut down by us, lianas will benefit. They will burst into those sunlit gaps, further tearing into the ragged edge of forests. Tropical forests, the green lungs of the planet, are actually decreasing in their ability to sequester CO2. And he adds the fact that lianas are increasing at the same time. It may not be a coincidence. Okay, let's go to National Geographic Kids magazine. Let's see, what is the name of this article? It was here somewhere. Oh, yes, Kawati. So you may not be familiar with this fur ball, which inhabits parts of South America, Central America, and North America, but you no doubt know about the mammal's famous family. The coati, spelled C-O-A-T-I, is closely related to the raccoon. And like its cousin, this mammal is the size of a large house cat, has a ringed tail, and it hangs out in trees, says April Copcino Myers. Snooze and choose. Unlike the nocturnal raccoon, which is active at night, the coatl mostly gets its Z's when it's dark. These animals turn treetops into bedrooms, even building comfy twig and leaf nests and branches for their babies. As a coati sleeps, it tucks its nose into its belly. During the day, the coati is all about snacking. It uses its long, flexible nose to probe gaps between rocks and search under piles of leaves for grub. Coatis eat insects, fruit, rodents, lizards, and small snakes. Some make noise. Female and baby coatis eat, sleep, and travel in packs of about 30. At age 2, males leave to live on their own. In a group, these animals are chatty, and they click, grunt, whistle, and bark as they forage for food. So while it may not be well known as its raccoon relatives, the coati definitely lets you know it's there. Okay, let's do another article here. Stick with National Geographic Kids' ocean habitat. From outer space, Earth looks like an awesome blue marble. That's because most of the Earth's surface, more than 70%, is covered by oceans. Bum bum, says Avery Hurt, who wrote this here. Earth, underwater. Oceans are areas of salty water that fill enormous basins on the Earth's surface. Even though Earth has one continuous body of salt water, scientists and geographers, they divide it into 5 different sections, from biggest to smallest. They are the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian, the Southern, and the Arctic oceans. Oceans are deep as well as wide. An average ocean is a little over 2 miles deep, but about 200 miles southwest of Guam in the Pacific Ocean, the water in the Mariana Trench, is almost 7 miles deep. That is the deepest part of the ocean. Climate control. Oceans help keep Earth's climate habitable. By moving water around the globe, the oceans help to keep places from getting too hot or too cold. Oceans also help keep the planet warm. In some way, the hot water in a bathtub stays warmer longer than hot chocolate in a small cup. The vast amount of warm water stores heat in the ocean. Then ocean currents carry that heat around the planet. Without oceans, the Earth would be an icy rock. Ocean or sea? The words ocean and sea are often used to mean the same thing. A sea, however, is a small area of an ocean, usually with land on several sides. The Mediterranean, nestled between Africa and Europe, the Baltic in the northern and central Europe, and the Caribbean between North, Central, and South America are all seas. Ocean life. Scientists think that up to 91% of marine species have not yet been identified, but there could still be as many as 700,000 of them. Most, 95%, are invertebrates, animals that don't have a backbone, such as jellyfish or shrimp. The most common vertebrate, an animal with a backbone, on Earth is the brittle mouth. a tiny ocean fish that glows in the dark and has needle-like fangs. Some of the smallest animals on Earth can be found in the ocean. Sea animals like zooplankton are so small you can only see them with a microscope. Big fish swim through these waters too, such as great white sharks, manta rays, and ocean sunfish. The largest animal ever to live on Earth is an ocean mammal called the blue whale. It's as long as two school buses. Dolphins, porpoises, and sea lions are also ocean-dwelling mammals. The ocean teems with plant life. Most are tiny algae called phytoplankton. And these microscopic plants have a big job. Through photosynthesis, they produce about half of the oxygen that humans and other land-dwelling creatures breathe. Bigger algae like seaweed and kelp also grow in the ocean and provide food and shelter for marine mammals. Watery habitats. Temperature, ocean depth, and distance from the shore determine the types of plants and animals living in an area of the ocean. These regions are called habitats. Coral reefs are one type of habitat. When tiny animals called polyps die, their skeletons harden so other polyps can live on top of them. Then those polyps die and more move in. After thousands of years, this becomes a complex structure called a coral reef that provides food and shelter for many kinds of ocean animals. In fact, coral reefs have been called the rainforests of the sea because of the wide variety of animals found there. Animals such as seahorses, clownfish, and sea turtles all live on coral reefs. And corals themselves are animals. They grab food from the water using tiny tentacle-like arms. Kelp forests along the coastlines of the Pacific and Antarctic oceans also provide food and shelter for marine life. These large, brown, rubbery plants have hollow, globe-shaped growths on the leaves called, pneumatocysts, I like that. They help the plants rise to the surface. Sea lions, whales, shorebirds, and other ocean animals make meals of these smaller critters that hide in the leaves. Other ocean habitats aren't actually in the ocean, such as estuaries. Estuaries are areas where rivers and oceans meet and have a mix of salt water and fresh water. Oysters, crabs, and many birds like great herons and egrets live in estuaries. Scientists estimate that we've only explored 5% of the ocean. Maybe you'll be the next person to discover a new species of fish or a deeper underwater trench. Okay, let's go to Frontiers for Young Minds. This article entitled Forest Cow's Secrets, Cracking the Code with Movement Sensors. Laura J. Nicolai wrote this with some other people there. Hide and Seek in the Norwegian Forest. What happens when you want to watch something but cannot due to difficult conditions, shy animals, rocky or steep areas, far away from roads? You use tools. In Norway, farmers have a limited number of fields they can use to produce food, both for humans and for livestock. In the summer, the fields must be used to produce food for the long winter. Farmers do this by sending their animals out into the forest during the summer growth season. The cows get some sun and fresh air, they eat grass and other plants, and their calves grow big and strong. However, the forest can contain very dense vegetation and rough terrain, and the cows are alone, no shepherd or guard dog with them. After not seeing humans for months, the cows can also become shy, making it difficult to approach them. Other difficulties the cows face can include hot and cold weather, diseases, accidents, and even carnivores. Very few researchers have studied how cows act in hard-to-reach areas, but they did it here. Different tools used to see the invisible. The cows we studied were equipped with collars that contain small devices that allow us to watch them without actually being with them in the forest. The collars collect information using sensors and send it back to researchers in the form of numbers. One sensor is a GPS device, just like the one on your phone or in your parents' car. GPS can be very useful for locating cows when they are far away from the forest. It can tell us where the cows go every day and every night. Another sensor is called a motion sensor or an accelerometer. It records how the cow is moving its head and neck, whether it's moving from side to side, forward, backward, or up or down. Do cows move up and down? Your phone uses a similar technology to count your steps or to automatically switch the way your screen is turned when you turn on your phone. The movement sensors can detect even the tiniest movements up to 10 times per second. Each time the collar stores three numbers, one for each direction the body is moving. So what do these numbers mean? Well, cows have many different body movements called behaviors, which include walking, eating, sleeping. Every behavior has its own unique combination of three numbers. After equipping our herds with special collars, we snuck into the forest and filmed some of the cows, catching them doing many behaviors in different situations. We wanted to film many situations, different cows, different breeds, different times of the day, and different types of forests. What was the next step in our quest? Well, matching our behaviors with the movement data. We could do this because both our video and our collar data were linked to the date and time when the numbers were recorded. This brought us to the final step of our quest to find the movement signatures, finding the combination of numbers linked to each behavior. We needed some help for this, as we had millions of cows, millions of rows of numbers, there it is, millions of cows, and this would have taken us forever using just our own brains. So we taught a computer how to do the job of creating the key to solve the mystery of the collar data. Bum, 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 bum. They can figure out patterns and decisions on their own. It's like a computer becoming a really good chess player and playing it a lot, but with all kinds of stuff like pictures, numbers, and words. Our job was to give the computer many examples of behaviors and the numbers that are connected to those behaviors, and then to test whether the computer could recognize special patterns that are repeated. Once this was done, we taught our program to run through all of our data to assign a movement signature to a behavior. We could also test the computer by checking whether it could recognize what cows were doing if we gave it movement data it had never seen before. Ah, they're trying to fake it out. So what were the cows doing in the forest? What we ultimately wanted was to be able to use the numbers we got from the collars to say, for example, the cows were busy eating from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Then they rested for a bit. We were absolutely able to do that. The computer could tell us whether the cows were walking, resting, or feeding. This had been done before, but only on cows that stayed in the safe fields around their farms. So we expected that simple behaviors like this would be recognized. But to our surprise, the computer could recognize up to 20 behaviors. Some of those include social behaviors such as, our cows are bumping their heads against each other. Our cows are licking each other. Our mama cows are feeding their calves. Recognizing these behaviors was new and very exciting for our future projects. This kind of data can also help farmers take better care of their animals, keeping them happy while they are in a forest. The importance of spying on cows. Cows are important for meat, milk, leather, soap, and many other products that humans use every day. Because the well-being of the animals in our care is very important, we must make sure we are not causing cows unnecessary stress by releasing them into nature, even for a limited time. With the tools we created, we can identify what forest cows are doing without ever disrupting them, all with the help of a collar. In addition to making sure that the cows seem happy and are acting normally, the data from the collars can help us study how cows chat, how they hang out with each other, how different herds communicate, or how mothers and calves behave. It could also give us more information about how cows respond to carnivores in the wild, or how various conditions, diseases, insects, weather, impact their energy levels. On top of this, we might be able to identify a cow that is sick or injured, which would help the farmer take better care of his entire herd. Okay, I got enough time, I think, for one more article. Let's go back to Dogo News for Kids. This is a weird story. Gene-edited pig kidney transplanted into living person for the first time. Marcella Bonnet wrote this article. In a world's first, U.S. scientists have successfully transplanted a genetically modified pig kidney into a living person. The March 21st, 2024 announcement comes just months after the successful completion of similar transplants in deceased individuals. The historic four-hour surgery was conducted by doctors at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. The 15-member transplant team included experts who had spent their entire careers working on organ research. Let's see, who is this? Dr. Tetsu Kawai. He's the lead surgeon. He says, right after the restoration of the blood flow to the kidney pinked up immediately and started to make urine. It was the most beautiful kidney I had ever seen. Let's see, they got here. Transplants performed by organ. They got a chart here as of March 2024. Let's see, transplants performed by organ, 27,332 kidney, that's the most. The liver follows with 10,660, pancreas, 102, kidney slash pancreas, 112, heart transplants performed as of March 2024, 4,545, and lung is 3,026. The organ recipient here, 62-year-old Richard Slayman, had end-stage kidney disease. He had received a human kidney from a donor in 2018. However, the organ began to fail in 2023, forcing Slayman to resume dialysis. Due to his condition, Slayman was eligible for the animal organ under the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Compassionate Use Program. This program allows patients with life-threatening conditions to access experimental treatments. They are often the patient's last hope. This was certainly true for Slayman. And they got the number of patients on the waiting list by organ as of March 2024. 89,101. By far, kidney is the most, followed by liver at 9,862. Heart is 3,436. The pig kidney was obtained from eGenesis. The biotechnology company edited the organ's DNA to remove harmful pig genes and added certain human genes to ensure that it would not be rejected by Slayman's body. Antibodies were also added to prevent the risk of infection in the patient. The Mass General medical team hopes the pig kidney will function well for many years. However, animal-to-human organ transplants are still in the early stage, and there are many unknowns. But so far, the signs are encouraging. On March 25th, 2024, the doctor said that Slayman was already walking the hospital halls and may even be allowed to go home soon. It was this Dr. Winfred Williams, the Associate Chief of Nephrology at Mass General, said, "It is really a groundbreaking milestone. Should the kidney continue to work well and this is a success, I think it represents a breakthrough in a number of different areas." And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.